Back together again, you and I wrapping up another big month, Monday, October 31st, 2022, on Connecticut Today. We welcomed Republican gubernatorial candidate Bob Stefanowski, kicking off the last full week of his campaign. Landmark Legal Foundation analyst Mike O'Neill offered his thoughts on Monday's U.S. Supreme Court arguments on affirmative action. We also had some of my thoughts on the media coverage and political reaction to an attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband in their San Francisco home. Joining us is the Republican nominee and candidate for governor here in Connecticut, as we are now a week and a day out from the elections. Bob Stefanowski is on the line. Bob, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm terrific. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you right now? What's today's itinerary, Bob, as we speak to you? What's now we're a week out. I know it's probably a lot of coffee and snacks, but where are you? What's going on?
Well, this morning we had a press conference up in Hartford. We've been endorsed by several police departments across the state, the Hartford Police, the Bridgeport Police, the Stamford Police, New Haven, Waterbury, and I think that's a testament to the plan that we've put together, Paul. In my humble view, this a police accountability bill that the governor passed, although there are some good elements to it, we need to protect our officers. And, you know, we saw the horrible thing in Bristol. And so we're suggesting, or we will, I should say, bring back qualified immunity for officers, get these police forces across the state fully staffed. And we got to get crime under control. It's out of control right now.
Bob, what's your response? I'll give you some time here if you want to respond to people who hear that and they say, oh, come on, Bob, the numbers actually, you know, aren't too bad. Yes, there's still some violent crime, but, you know, they constantly point to some of the numbers saying we're doing a better job. What's your answer to all that?
Well, I would say a couple things, and I think you've had Laura Devlin on who expressed the same thing. We've been doing bus tours across the state. I have not met one person, Paul, and this is not a political slant here. I've not met one person that feels like they feel safer than they did 4 years ago. And you know how it is. Statistics can prove anything. And I would point to the fact that rape is up 23%, that the city of Hartford is having its most violent year in two decades, that homicides are up. Police do not feel supported by this governor. That's why they're all leaving. That's why we're undermanned. And the state police is down 400 officers. Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven down over 100 officers. And we got to do something. The Connecticut used to be a safe place. We used to respect law enforcement under Governor Lamont. That has dwindled away, and we're going to bring it back.
Now, Bob, if you're elected governor, obviously, you're the governor, you're not the chief administrator of many of these cities and towns who are struggling to retain officers. How would a Stefanowski administration help in that? What can you do, even though you're kind of detached, as any governor would be, from the day-in and day-out machinations of a municipality? How would you help Bridgeport and Hartford and New Haven and Waterbury make sure that their police departments are fully staffed and morale is good?
Well, we have a $6 billion budget surplus. And the reason we have that is they moved $6 billion of our federal tax money from the federal government down to Connecticut. And we should be doing something with that money. Governor Lamont doesn't seem to want to touch into it. It's not his money. It's your listeners' money. And as governor, I'm going to give some of it back. I mean, you know, you vary from police for a minute. We've got oil bills. People are filling their oil tank halfway through. We've got inflation at 40-year highs. I'm seeing people making a choice between buying prescription medicine and feeding their family. And we should have some minimum threshold for officers and start paying them more to attract people in. Same thing with teachers. We've got the city of Hartford opened this year with 90 substitute teachers. So I don't know why in the world the governor won't give some of this money back to us. They taxed us too much. He's sitting on $6 billion. He calls it a rainy day fund. It's a rainy day right now, and Laura and I are going to give that money back to taxpayers.
Bob Stefanowski is the guest, the Republican nominee for governor. Bob, I guess tomorrow night is the last debate here, a week out. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I wish the governor had agreed to do more than two. He's done several candidate forums, but for whatever reason, he's reluctant to be in the same room with me. I would have loved to have done one in Fairfield County. But anyways, let's put that aside. Listen, I tell people, Paul, if you honestly believe you're safer than you were 4 years ago, and you think Connecticut is more affordable than it was 4 years ago, and you feel like you've got more control over what your kid learns in school or whether he or she wears a mask or whether he or she gets vaccinated for COVID, and you think infrastructure is better, vote for more Governor Lamont. But I'm telling you, we can do better. We shouldn't be satisfied with the second highest taxes in the country and the highest utility costs. Laura and I have introduced a plan to give half of that budget surplus back. It's about $2,200 per family, takes the edge off. Connecticut Family Bill of Rights put parents back in charge of raising their kids, get government out of the way, and also a plan called Safe Connecticut, which is to restore power back to law enforcement and support these men and women and keep us safe. I haven't heard any plans from the governor as to what he's going to do going forward, other than raise taxes on gas on December 1st and put a highway use tax in on January 1st. That's all we've heard.
You know, Bob, I'm watching this from a few steps away as a voter and a talk show host and nothing else. And, you know, the mantra that we've heard against you and against every Republican here in the state, frankly, and I kind of allude to it, you know, is Trump, guns, and abortion. And even though you can argue that all three of those aren't really huge issues that are going to see any major changes in this state, you know, they've kept hammering that. And Bob, I want to give you a few minutes here now, or a few seconds if you want to, because a lot of people, frankly, they just read or they hear snippets or they may have not watched that candidate forum. You know, last week you said something that you came out and you quickly corrected. So just kind of walk us through that, because frankly, Bob, you and I know that a lot of people maybe didn't watch that or hear just what they want to hear. So you said you made a misstatement during that candidate forum.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing it. Let me go through all three. First of all, with respect to Donald Trump, if he had anything to do with January 6th, he should be held accountable. There's an investigation. If he's found to be guilty, he should be held accountable just like anybody else. Joe Biden won the election. Let's move on. And I don't like the personal side of Donald Trump. I've got three daughters. I don't like what comes out. I do agree on some of his policies in terms of putting America first and reducing taxes, but I don't like the personal side of him. That's number one. Number two, guns. We've got the toughest gun laws in the nation. I'm not going to change them. But what we need to do is we need to start enforcing them. Most of the issues that we see are not issues with the law. It's Governor Lamont not resourcing police departments to enforce the law and also not funding the mental health part of that bill to get kids, you know, before they get into trouble. On abortion, Governor Lamont has been lying for 6 months. And unfortunately, I misspoke for the first time in 6 months. Let me put it this way. Abortion, Roe v. Wade, is codified into Connecticut state law. It's part of our law. That law is not going to change as long as I'm governor. I support a woman's right to choose. I agree with Connecticut law. It's not going to change. And you know why the Democrats focus on these three issues? Because they can't talk about public safety. They can't talk about the economy and how unaffordable it is. They can't talk about parental rights. And that's why they're deferring to this. But I would plead and beg your listeners, I am not the evil guy that Governor Lamont paints on TV and the attack as. I'm a decent guy. I grew up in New Haven. I got three daughters. I've had a beautiful family and career here. And I'm just looking to help the state, Paul. It's as simple as that.
Bob, one thing that I just go nuts on, I mean, literally my head almost explodes, is every time we see one of these ratings of Connecticut as a business-friendly state or lack thereof. Bob, whether it comes from the Wall Street Journal or CNBC or Wallet Hub, I mean, Bob, we tend to improve a little bit, but then, you know, one step forward, two steps back, we're in the 40s, near the bottom of the heap in the country. What would you do? What can a governor do, Bob, to make, you know, Connecticut more appealing to businesses, which you and I know, these surveys come out and CEOs and CFOs, they read these numbers, Bob, and they say, well, look at this. Nah, we can't consider Connecticut because of this, this, and this. And we've been battling that, Bob, for years now. What could be different thinking on this?
Well, first of all, you're right. CNBC rated our economy an F, and we dropped 15 points in terms of our attractiveness to do business. Number one is clearly taxes. We've got over 330 taxes and fees in Connecticut. The bottom 200 generate less than 0.25% of the total revenue of Connecticut. So Laura and I are going to abolish the bottom 200. We're going to save money. We're going to make the regulation easier. That's number one. Second is there's an unemployment insurance loan that we don't have time to talk about, but it's hammering small business because they have to pay it off. Every other state pretty much has used COVID money to pay that off. We need to pay that off. The third thing you hear from small business is there's not enough qualified workers. There's 1,000 open jobs. So we need to reinvest in our trade schools, our charter schools. We need to, I'm a product of the public education in Connecticut. I grew up in New Haven and North Haven. We need to start preparing kids for a career and leave the kitchen table issues to the kitchen table and start teaching these kids math and science and all that other good stuff. So the short answer, Paul, is I can do a ton when I win to make us more competitive, but you got to have the desire. And I'm asking people to take a little bit of a chance. I know it's easy to vote for Governor Lamont. You know what you got. And I know change is hard, but if you don't think we can do better than what we're doing right now, we can absolutely do better. And give me a chance.
You, Bob, are, like you said, you're a Connecticut native, been here most of your life, me too. But in crisscrossing the state now for two election cycles, what are one or two things to wrap up here, or maybe a little bit of a lighter note, Bob? What are one or two things that a lot of people really don't realize about the state, even if they've spent their entire lives here? You know, we're a small state, but a lot of us don't get out of our cocoons. What have all these years of campaigning, you think, brought to light for you?
I'll tell you two things, Paul. One is the diversity of our state. I mean, I never knew we had dairy farms up in the northern part of the state or some of the agriculture we have up there. You go down to Fairfield County and you've got financial services business. I mean, it's a tremendous advantage for us with the diversity to build back this economy. And then the second one is there are so many good people out there. I mean, we handed out 1.5 million surgical masks in COVID. We did it with the Jewish Federation of Greater New Haven. There are some terrific community activists. We see people all over the state stepping up for coat drives. People are worried about filling, you know, their oil tank this year. They're filling it halfway full because they can't afford it. So you got a lot of others doing really great things to try to compensate for it. But we got a terrific state. And I know I'm biased, but after 12 years of a Democratic governor and 40 years of Democratic rule, we got so much to build on. We just need to take a little bit of a risk and let me in. I've turned around troubled organizations my entire career. I can do it for the state of Connecticut.
Bob Stefanowski, we thank you for your time. Take care, and we'll all be watching the debate tomorrow. Bob, thanks. Take care.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
All right, there you go. Bob Stefanowski from the campaign trail. Welcoming back one of our legal eagles, attorney Mike O'Neill from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Yes, some key arguments today in the Supreme Court. Whenever we have a key SCOTUS case or two or three, we invite some folks, including Mike, on to decode all this. Mike, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you?
Good, good, good. Well, it never seems to go away, Mark, and no. Mike, rather, and it's an interesting discussion. We've been having this back and forth, I think, Mike, for the better part of six decades now, like three generations, affirmative action.
Right.
And when it comes to, in particular, college admissions, which
right.
is a real hot button about this. So, Mike O'Neill, what is the high court considering here, and what were you able to glean from some of the arguments you may have heard today?
Right. So two cases before the Supreme Court, and they're essentially, you know, a little nuanced distinction between the two. But for essentially, it is affirmative action. The two cases, Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard and Students for Fair Admission versus UNC, University of North Carolina. And these cases, for all intents and purposes, one of them deals with the Civil Rights Act. Specifically Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and that's the Harvard case. That's determining whether a school, a private institution like Harvard that receives federal funding is prohibited under the Civil Rights Act from discriminating on the basis of race in admissions. And the UNC case actually is the 14th Amendment, is the constitutional case, is the case whether a public institution, of course, this is the University of North Carolina, so it is a state institution, it is a state entity, whether it can discriminate on the basis of race, whether it is prohibited from discriminating on the basis of race under the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment prohibits the discrimination on the basis of race. So generally the same cases. One is federal funding and one is the constitutional issue. But what it really goes down to is whether affirmative action, whether students of certain races will receive preferential treatment in the admissions process. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of debate about that today. It was a really long oral argument. I mean, we had two sessions, essentially. You had a morning session, you had an afternoon session, and you had some of the leading lights of the appellate advocacy movement arguing both sides of this. So it was a really well-argued case here today, so a full airing of all of the issues. But really what it boils down to is going forward is whether the universities will be permitted to use race as a factor in considering whether to admit a student who applies for admission to their institution.
More discussion here for a few more minutes. Mike O'Neill, one of our legal eagles, Landmark Legal Foundation. Check him out, landmarklegal.org. Oral arguments today, a morning session and an afternoon session. Two different angles, two cases regarding racial preferences in college, admissions. And Mike, you had mentioned that one of the important distinctions here that people should know is that these are cases, and correct me if I'm wrong, which on whether or not to allow race or racial makeup to be one factor. We're not talking about race being the complete deciding factor, are we?
Well, that's actually really a great question. That's kind of the point. If you really want to boil it down here, it's whether it's dispositive, okay? And I think that there is a lot of argument, and I think you really can't the advocates in favor of these policies couldn't really escape the simple fact that in a percentage of cases, race becomes dispositive. We're dealing with an all or nothing proposition here. You're either admitted to the university or you're not admitted to the university. And when you boil it down here, if you compare apples to apples, so if you compare an Asian student and a white student, for example, and the white student has a grade point average of 3.5, SAT scores of 1300, the Asian student has a grade average of 3.5 and SAT scores of 1300, exact same scores. The Asian student has a lesser chance of gaining admissions to these elite universities than the white student. And similarly, you can track that all the way up. The Asian student will have a lesser chance of admissions than a Hispanic student with similarly situated test scores, grade average, college resume, et cetera, et cetera. So it can be is it considered a factor or is it considered the dispositive factor? And it is the record is fairly clear. And I think the advocates who were opposing these programs, were opposing Harvard and University of North Carolina, established the fact that in a number of cases, race is dispositive. Therefore, really, it really puts the advocates, these universities, in a bind when there's really no wiggle room, and they have to concede that if race is dispositive, then you do have a violation of the 14th Amendment. You do have a violation of the Civil Rights Act. Now, so there was a lot of questions. There was a lot of argument about diversity and diversity as a compelling state interest. That was what you heard. That is the goal of these universities, is to achieve racial diversity. And in other words, to do this, and diversity is good. So a lot of the justices, Justice Thomas, kept saying, well, what is diversity? And what is diversity for diversity's sake? What is it? Are the benefits clear? And so there was a lot of attempts on the part of the universities to establish that racial diversity is necessary. And in order to achieve this, the only way we can achieve this is by using race as something to consider in our admissions process. Of course, the other side was saying, well, no, there are ways to achieve this racial diversity through less intrusive means. You could do something like the 10% admissions, where any student who graduates from the top 10% of their class in any high school in North Carolina, if you graduate in the top 10% of your high school class, doesn't matter what your grade average is, doesn't matter what your SAT scores, you're guaranteed admissions to Chapel Hill, for example. So there was a lot of that going on.
And also, Mike, you have, at least in the UNC case, you have the added specter here of this being a state school, which does, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but is there any argument saying, hey, if this is a state school ostensibly supported somehow by state tax revenues, is there some obligation of the state treating people fairly? Because you could argue that state tax revenue should make this colorblind or not. I don't know.
Right. That's the 14th Amendment argument that you're saying.
Okay.
Exactly. Public revenue flows into these universities. And I think really there was a little bit. It's interesting when you hear some of the justices talk. There's a bit of elitism that was coming through from the liberal side of the bench there, that as if that admissions to UNC and admission to Harvard, UNC Chapel Hill, and admission to Harvard is the only path to success in our country. Keep in mind, we have a huge, massive university and college institutions or industrial complex in our country. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of colleges and universities for people to be admitted to. So it and the presumption that somehow the only way to achieve success in this country is by gaining admission to Harvard or gaining admission to UNC Chapel Hill, I think is ridiculous. I think that there are many opportunities for success and many roads to success in this country, and I don't think it should be conditioned upon being admitted to Harvard or UNC Chapel Hill. Your future isn't certainly foreclosed upon you in our country if you don't gain admissions to these universities. Finally, one other point here is if these universities believe that racial diversity is such a huge goal, why don't they increase the size of their student body?
See, they're billions, so like build another couple of dorms. I don't get this.
Right, exactly. That's what it's not like Harvard is lacking for resources. No, but these universities want to have their cake and eat it too, Paul. They want to have their cake and eat it too. Harvard wants to maintain a class admission of 1,600, right? They can't, can't have 3,500.
Yeah.
So they want to have, but they want to have it in such a manner. They want to tinker it with in such a manner that they get right down to it, that it's an accurate representation. So just, hey, Harvard, build a few more dorms and allow more, and increase your enrollment. No, you can't do that because you could increase your acceptance and that might affect your ranking.
No. And see, this is the kind of thing that, you know, was made me happy that I grew up in the shade of Yale during my formative years in New Haven. Mike, final thing, what did we glean, if anything, for you folks who have your antenna up about this? What do we glean today from what you heard or may not have heard from Ketanji Brown Jackson, the new justice?
She does have an interesting take now on this, and this was in the UNC argument. Her take is, and it is interesting from an originalist standpoint. So she's kind of adopted this originalist tack here, where she says the 14th Amendment wasn't originally intended. The Reconstruction amendments weren't originally intended to engage in race blind society, a color blind society. No, they were intended to remedy discrimination and remedy all the vestiges of slavery. So that's kind of an interesting argument. It's going to be interesting to see how the court tackles that and how originalists tackle that. So she's kind of making her mark with that new argument. She proffered that earlier in her earlier arguments. She kind of telegraphed that this is where she was going. So a really interesting argument. It's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. Long term, we're going to see, obviously, the winds of the conservative, so-called conservative majority here are We'll see whether I'm guarded again. Standing statement here for me, guardedly optimistic that we're going to see an overturning of the Grutter decision, which was the one in the early 2000s that kind of continued on this. So we will see though. But one more prediction for you. This will probably be the last decision. You know, we probably won't find out about where the court's going with this thing until late June. So we'll
see. Of course. Final decision. The limousines will be running. See you later when they do this. Mike O'Neill.
Sure.
Mike, thank you. Appreciate it as always. Take care.
My pleasure, Paul. You have a great day.
All right, there you go. Our legal analyst from the conservative Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. What did Mike say there? Could be the final be-all and end-all Supreme Court case on race-based admissions, preferences, and all that. Good point, though. Why don't these schools just build more? Well, you know, we have to only allow 1,600. No. Build more doors. You'll get more donors. You'll help that endowment. But let's start with this on Halloween, not to be spooky. Can everybody please, I am begging you again and again and again and again and again, calm down. Calm the you-know-what down. Can't say it, I'd be out of a job. But, oh, God, do I want to tell people just to calm the down. What am I talking about? The whole Paul Pelosi thing. Let's start with this. It is horrible that somebody was subjected to a hammer attack by clearly some guy who was clearly being referred to by all people that knew him as a nut. as a psycho, as a sicko. But man, to listen to this stuff you heard over the weekend, you would have thought, well, this guy's a mainstream staffer for the Republican Party. Oh, well, all of you people, shut up and calm down. The rhetoric over this thing, well, you know, this is dangerous rhetoric. It's dangerous rhetoric if you're a nutcase. But here we are, you know, one side quick to get the advantage over the other. Well, this is clearly what's happened and what's going to happen if you vote a certain way next week in the midterms. Oh, my God. Is this the height, the absolute height of irresponsibility? Yes, you can be outraged over this whole thing, but come on. You've got to ask yourself some questions here. And I'm not saying this was some sort of big false flag operation. But what did I say about this a few days ago? We were on the air. It happened on Friday. So we talked about this late Friday toward the end of the show. And my immediate thought on this was the immediate thought, I think, of about 98% of people with a functioning brain. Where was the security of the Pelosi home in San Francisco? Now, supposedly, the San Francisco PD is going to come out and have a news conference either later today or tomorrow. And hopefully that will clear up a lot of stuff. But the immediate thought here is, by again, anybody who actually, I don't know, is alive, is not crazy, has a functioning brain, the immediate thought here, beyond the fact that you want Paul Pelosi to make a full recovery, and by a miracle, I guess he's going to, even though the guy was subjected to a hammer attack, they say, by this guy, David DePappy, who, even by people who know him, say he's a nut. He's a mental case. But you have to ask yourself, why was a whack job, why was a crank able to, I don't know, breach any sort of security? Was there active security at the home of the number three person in all of the federal government? Let's remember this. Nancy Pelosi or whomever is a Speaker of the House, no matter who's in power in the White House, no matter who controls Congress, the House Speaker is the overall number three person in the U.S. government. It goes President, Vice President, Speaker of the House, or House Speaker, the way, whatever way you'd like to frame it. And, you know, that person after the president is the number two person in the line of succession. Okay. I get that. I understand that. But the question that I think everybody is wondering about, that maybe we'll get some answers to, maybe, will we? I don't know. How was this nut job able to get in the House? And again, maybe there are obvious answers here. Maybe the police will, lay this all out either today or tomorrow or whenever this guy is, you know, formally charged here, formally indicted. They said they're going to do it whether he's able to attend a court hearing or in absentia, whether the guy's still going to be, you know, locked up somewhere in jail or locked up in a hospital, whatever. But my God, the stuff you're hearing over the weekend is, and you know, a lot of it, frankly, is irresponsible. You know, when you get a lot of people, mainly on the Democratic side, going, well, you know, this is what you may be voting for come midterm election day, a week from this coming Tuesday. Oh, shut up. That is so irresponsible. And yes, is some of the political dialogue coming out of both sides irresponsible today? Of course it is. Nobody is saying that. But again, can we please, I am begging you, you know, I have to go back to this mantra, this meme every so often of telling people to calm the down. This is not the end of the world. And let me tell you this too. And again, please don't take this the wrong way, because I think you'll know where I'm coming from here. As horrible as what happened to Paul Pelosi was, and it was, and thank God the guy's going to make it, because as Nancy Pelosi said statement that she released late yesterday, I guess after going to visit her husband, you know, he's my husband, he's our pop, our grandpop, you know, whatever. There's a family dynamic there. But it's getting the play it's getting, and should be, because of what had happened and how this guy was able to breach any sort of security they have. But how about the numerous times I'm sure that happens on any given day to anyone else, to anybody else who happens to be a Republican or a Democrat or lean right and lean left. And, you know, we don't hear about it. So in a sad, crazy, and unfortunate way, maybe this does emphasize, you know, some of these problems that we still do not want to confront. Again, this guy that you know, allegedly broke into this home and assaulted Paul Pelosi says right here in this version of the story that I'm looking at. Now, can anybody else find this? I don't know. I don't have some secret decoder ring key to the internet. I mean, I've been able to find it. He's been called mentally ill by people who know him and continue to post online conspiracy theories. DePape, I think it's pronounced, is a conspiracy theorist who frequently posted online, and according to his purported ex-life partner, Oxanne Taub, has been, quote, mentally ill for a long time. Taub went on to detail one incident where DePape reportedly came home after disappearing for more than a year. That's stable, yeah. Taub said, quote, he came back in very bad shape. He thought he was Jesus. He was constantly paranoid, thinking people were after him. And it took a good year or two to get back to, you know, being halfway normal. DePape facing charges of attempted homicide, assault with a deadly weapon, elder abuse, burglary, and other felonies following the incident. Now, of course, the White House, you know, the cheap shot artists they are, they couldn't wait. They couldn't wait. Karine Jean-Pierre said, quote, the thing that is probably the most haunting about when we hear reports of this assailant, of the attacker that you were speaking of, is that he was yelling out things that we heard during January 6th, which is, where is Nancy? And, you know, again, we need to end this type of rhetoric. It needs to stop. And it's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. So, again, even though the guy was a nutcase, and even though anybody with any amount of mental illness is gradually going to gravitate to some sort of national memes because that's all they hear, it's immediately made political. But with the bunch in the White House now and the stuff you get every day, are you surprised? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. This goes back to an axiom that I've maintained on this program for months and months and months and months. We are too quick to ascribe with normalcy folks that are out of their freaking mind stuff that they do. Well, you know, he heard stuff he heard on January 6th. Yeah, and he's also out of his mind. How many people out there today do you think are mumbling to themselves or fixated on stuff they hear on the far right and on the far left, huh? But, oh, my God, all you heard Friday, Saturday, Sunday, early today, well, it's obviously the political rhetoric out there. Well, no, it's not. It's not obvious. It's just political rhetoric. It's not. Do people in his case hear stuff that they gravitate to? Yes, they do. That's because they're crazy and we're not.